I have, are we set? Are our machines going? I have here several pages from the conclusion of one of the most famous books of criticism in the 20th century, The Heritage of Symbolism by C.M. Bora. Cecil Bora was a classical scholar at Oxford, but also was a great appreciator of poetry, and his poetic teeth were sharpened on doing a very famous translation of Pindar's works. Pindar is the most difficult of all classical poets because his syntax runs into such strange configurations that it's very easy to mistake what he wrote. And Bora, once reviewing another man's translation of Pindar, closed his unappreciation of the other man's failed effort by saying, "One should not take eagles for short walks on short leashes." Eagles are meant to fly, and you have to turn them loose. And great poets are like eagles. They have to be turned loose. They need to be given that kind of emotional space, that kind of intellectual time, so that within that time space they can be free. And their words, if they are the words of a very great poet, are able to be mobile in the largest amphitheater of personal dimension that we are capable of. And in fact, one of the great hallmarks of world-class poetry is that it brings out, evokes in us, the largest dimensions of the person. Now, we're going to look at Euripides and Basho and Mallarmé, three very, very great poets from quite different cultures. Classical Greek, the Japanese shogunate, and the French Impressionist Romantic school, symbolist school. Bora, on the second page, what would be numbered here as page 220, writes of Mallarmé that he was fully conscious of this limitation of the poet's sphere and made a virtue of it. He believed that it was a great advantage because it forced him to be only a poet, to concentrate his real task to write pure poetry. His own verse has much of the quality of incantation. The thought in it, the mere meaning, emerges gradually after the magic has done its work. He creates in his readers a complex state in which understanding plays only a small part. His successors have followed him, but not all the way. And so we begin with this notion, highlighted for us by Bora's wonderful sense of appreciation and critical acumen. The sense here, great poetry frequently has a quality of incantation. Now, incantation would be the kind of language that would accompany ritual. And the ritual level, the ritual comportment, one would have language styled in incantation. But notice also, we have definitely the sense that incantation has a magical appropriateness also. In other words, a poetic incantation is not only for ritual but also for magic, and so we understand that the concept of incantation, the practice may be ritual, but the concept includes the magical, in fact weighs it to magic, so that an incantation is really a magical language performing in a ritual mode. Now, in a natural comportment, ritual accompaniment by language, the language is always mythic. So that there is a twist here in having poetry as an incantation. It's a kind of a twist that includes notions like allegory, like saying two things at once, two things that would be quite disparate, separated, able to be distinguished, but somehow twisted together and made to function as one, so that there is an allegorical quality here of double vision, of double seeing. The very essence of magical language is that it has this capacity of double seeing. But it's double seeing in the sense of not double seeing in a blur, but double seeing at one and the same time. To use filmic language, the montage of the second meaning is exactly contiguous with the first meaning, so that one sees a depth of symbolic reference here, that linking the two distinct meanings together exactly is a deep experience, the experience of the deep self. And what one sees, if I can use a diagrammatic figure in language, it's like one sees a point in a mythic reference and at the same time sees a point in a magical reference. But because the two are contiguous, occur together, the sense is not that there is a line of separation between them, but that both occur in a sphere of meaning that has for its focus the center of the sphere, and that the line linking the two points of meaning, the mythic and the magical, is a diameter through the sphere. So much so that if one rotated that line of double meaning, one would be able to reconstruct the entire sphere of understanding, the sphere whose center is the deep self. But that center point seems unattainable. One can't really get there. One approaches it, or one has gone by it, and then in reflection understands that you have gone by it, but one never gets there. The there is not there. So that the center of the sphere of complete meaning, the deep self, is forever elusive. Yet it does occur. And because of this, the classical way to talk about this kind of experience is mysticism, the mystical. And in fact, this wonderful volume published by the University of California Press on Mallarmé and the language of mysticism. And just to give you a couple of sentences from this, the first chapter on mystical consciousness. Any final answer to the question of the nature of mysticism must be reserved uniquely for the mystics themselves, since one of the most nearly universal characteristics of their experience, according to the widest range of historical and contemporary testimony, is that it is indescribable. One sees, one feels, one knows, but one cannot tell. Seemingly, no mystic has ever been completely satisfied with his efforts to communicate his own vision. So what is mysticism? The first condition of mystical insight is the presence of a deep spiritual sense of the mystery of being, of the isolation of consciousness surrounded by the void, of light by darkness. So that there is a sense that there is a light surrounded by darkness. There is a center surrounded by a sphere. So that if one tries to become conscious of the context of the sphere, the point disappears. As the sphere becomes illuminated, the point becomes dark, the center. And one gets caught in a kind of a very sophisticated catch-22. Or one becomes subject to the limitations of an indeterminacy principle like that uttered by Werner Heisenberg, that the observer can know either the time or the place, but neither the time and the place together. You can have one aspect of its true dimension, but not the other. And so one can have an experience of the center, but then the entire sphere of meaning is mysterious, is actually experienced as a void. Or one can focus on the sphere, and then the center is void, seemingly so. So that the quality of appreciation for the reality of it is that one somehow must juxtapose two references, one that seems to focus on the fulcrum, the center, and the other which focuses on the sphere, the context. The context is always imbued with a mythic sense. Myths, the mythic language, are always about context. Whereas the magical quality of language is always about the center of the pattern, so that the structure of the pattern, which is symbolically summed up by the center, is of concern. So that in the mythic one has a sense of content and context, and in the magical one has a sense of structure. And bringing that structure and that content together to give the fullness, this is the peculiar quality of magical language, of poetry. High poetry has this ability. So when we come to a poet like Mallarmé, and I must give you translation in English, I'm unable to read French adequately out loud. This is from Hérodiade. This is from the University of California Press collection of Mallarmé's poems done some while ago. Just a selection. Abolished and her frightful wings and the tears of the pool abolished that mirrors her alarms. The naked gold's thrashing crimson space, an aura has heraldic plumage, chosen our cinerary and sacrificial tower, heavy tomb whence a beautiful bird has fled, solitary caprice of dawn with vain black plumage. Ah, the manor house of sad and fallen lands, no plashing, the gloomy water is resigned, no longer visited by plume or swan, never forgotten, the water reflects the yielding of autumn, extinguishing therein his torch. Of the swan, when amid the pallid mausoleum, where he plunged his feathery head in grief for the pure diamond of some star, but long ago, a star that never scintillated. And so you get an eerie sense with Mallarmé, even in a translation like this, that whatever imagery is operating, the images do not cohere as an image base. The juxtaposition of the images is such that they seem to slide along one another's edge, and instead of forming an image base, they begin to slide and form a kind of a prismatic, seemingly fractured structure. But instead of a fractured structure in a positive mode, a scintillating structure, much like a star can be seen in its clear accuracy, but the mirror of the star in the water, when the water has been, the surface tension has been ruffled, the reflection of the star is seemingly shattered, but is actually scintillating. And so, in consciousness, what is clear in consciousness, in nature, is experienced as fragmented or as scintillating, as a shimmering, unjuxtaposed incoherency. What is clear in consciousness, what is symbolically able to be envisioned in the mind, which is clearly at the center, cannot be experienced in nature. In the natural experience of that, it's only a glow, it's only a shimmer. Or at best, one can resolve the shimmer, resolve the glow into a sense of fragmentation, of odd juxtaposition. So that the clarity of consciousness becomes a mystery in nature. But the clarity of nature becomes hidden in consciousness. It occurs not. One can say unconscious, but this is an idea of it and not the actual experience. So that nature has a phantom quality to consciousness. And in complement to that, in nature, consciousness has a mysterious shimmer, a fragmented, shimmering kind of a quality. What is difficult is that when one first matures to the ability to have enough consciousness to be clear to oneself about your own deep self-experience, the natural tendency, I almost have to put quotation marks around natural here because I'm using it metaphorical, but the tendency is to make a comparison with what one is now compared to what one was before. How you are now with how you were before. But the comparison, the montage, does not hold. Instead, the experience is that one flits from one to the other, like a pendulum, like a ping-pong game, as the Zen phrase would have. One is alternately mystified by one aspect or the other. At the same time, one is very clear about one aspect or the other. And what is most elusive is that fulcrum where the two clarities could jibe, where the two mysteries would be resolved and come together. And the naive attempt is to try to make that center happen. Force by one's magical power or by one's mythical power for that symbolic self to be definite. And this is the tragedy of the Bacchae. This cannot be done. And like in Mallarmé's language here, we get the sense very, very clearly here. The only way in which this can occur is to express in some artistic way the incommensurability of this activity. To recognize that by saying the mystery accurately is the best that we can do. We cannot resolve the mystery except to state the irresolution accurately. And the stating of the irresolution accurately is the very essence of art. That we are quite clear that we are unclear forever. But there is a kind of magic efficacy in being able to do this. There is a calmness, an assurity that this is enough. What we have done is enough. It will be sufficient. Now, when we come to When we come to Euripides, I'm going to give you a couple of sentences from this book, The Greeks and the Irrational, by E.R. Dodds, also originally published by University of California Press. I seem to be using Cal Press books today. This is a paperback reprint. It's very old, and I think there's a different publisher for it now. E.R. Dodds. He's writing of the Greeks and the Irrational, and this chapter, From Shame Culture to Guilt Culture, in other words, from other-directed to inner-directed balancing. The shame culture, you depend on others to direct your sense of form and adjustment. In a guilt culture, it's your inner quality. Notice here that in a shame culture, to use these terms, I don't usually use these terms, but they're viable in this particular example. In a shame culture, you must have your rituals in configuration with everyone else's. Your myths must be their myths. You must fit in. The problem in a guilt culture is not that you must fit into them, but you must fit them into you. You must accept those rituals. You must accept those myths. But on the basis of accepting the rituals and accepting the myths, you must make some symbolic adjustment within yourself in order to do this. To just participate in the rituals, to just believe in the myths, is not enough. For if you have not made a symbolic adjustment, then you suffer that tragical paradox that you are impugning the sacred by participating in a sham way with the right actions, believing the myths but not really believing them or understanding them deep within. So there is a difference here. So that the Greeks had two words which have passed into the English language. We still use them in the English language. But the Greek words were honed in the time of the 4th century BC, the time of Euripides. They were made to express quite accurately the dilemma of which I'm now speaking to you of. The two words are miasma and catharsis. Dodds writes, this is page 35 in The Greeks and the Irrational, and that brings me to the last general trait which I want to stress, the universal fear of pollution, miasma. Now we usually think of miasma as a kind of a swampy mess, or as complications so thick that one could never sort it out. The true, accurate idea there is that this is a universal fear of pollution. In other words, the peril for you, the danger for you, is impurity. I think that if I could add the word here, contamination. The Greek word miasma has within it the sense of, it's like a radioactive contamination. If you touch this, you are contaminated. Notice that there's a magnetic quality here. So that contamination itself cannot be dealt with. There is no way to deal with miasma. There is no way to deal with pollution. That is to say, there is no normal, natural way to deal with it. The way in which pollution can be dealt with, this danger handled, is that it must be counterbalanced by purity. but that the purity cannot come from anything that you are, nor from anything that you are able to do on your own. The catharsis must come from the divine, must come from outside of your capacity, and yet touch you. The only place that something divine can touch you without getting woven into the pollution is dead center in your being at the deep self. The very point when you're looking at the context, the contamination, the danger that is hidden from you, and the God can mysteriously come, the divine can mysteriously touch you at that hidden center. And so the balance of the catharsis is a divine gift to the deepest hidden part of one's sphere of reality. Here's how Dodds writes it. And that brings me to the last general trait, which I want to stress, the universal fear of pollution, miasma, and its correlate, the universal craving for ritual purification, catharsis. Here, once again, the difference between Homer and the archaic age is relative, not absolute. For it is a mistake to deny that a certain minimum of catharsis is practiced in both epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey. But from the simple Homeric purifications performed by laymen, it is a long step to the professional cathartai of the archaic age with their elaborate and messy rituals. And he goes on to say that there is a tremendous extension of this sense of man being adept at working the catharsis in terms of the miasma, of purifying the pollution. What is the worst pollution possible, the worst contamination possible? And the Greek reply to that was hubris, pride, egotistical pride, arrogance, is the worst disease of which man is capable. Why? Because it hides from him the only source of balance, the deep self which is hidden. And the arrogance appropriates that fulcrum for its own self. And so some personal role, some social role in the Bacchae Pentheus is the king. I am the king. And what one might add a gratuitous God damn it. I am the king, God damn it. I can do what I want to do. And in fact, I must be able to do what I want to do to defend the kingdom. This is the prerogative of the king, the royal prerogative of the king. And so the most energized and compulsive of all the arrogant roles is when the ego appropriates for itself the royal prerogative. If I don't maintain my authority, then the world is lost. I am the only defender, you see. And so egotism gets raised to its ultimate level, to its asymptotic and breaking level, that of hubris, pride. And the old saying, which we still have colloquially, pride comes before the fall. What is the fall? From the pinnacle of false self-importance, where does one fall? One falls by the law of universal recompense to the real center of the personality. But if your belief and your compulsive confidence is all placed on that pinnacle, the return back to the true deep self is seen as a fall into the abyss, a plunge into the unknown. It's seen as the death of the ego. And in the Bacchae, of course, the way Pentheus dies is that Dionysus bends a pine tree down, and Euripides has this beautiful symbolic image that he bends the pine tree in full circle so that the tip comes to the base. And Pentheus climbs onto the tip of the pine, and then Dionysus lets it go in such a way that the pine goes right back up to its straightness. And Pentheus is, he thinks, safe and illuminated at the top of the tree, and instead he is at the pinnacle of his hubris and can only fall to his death from there. And in fact is killed by his mother and his aunts and all the other Bacchae in the most powerful way. They not only stone him from the top of a cliff as he's hanging in the tree, but they finally come down and with the young trees used as levers, they pry at the roots and finally massively tear the pine out of the ground, and he falls to his death, and they pounce on him and tear him from limb to limb. So that this sense of structure which Euripides illuminates in the Bacchae is extremely important. The catharsis. Dodds writes, I shall come back to the subject of catharsis in a later chapter, but it is time now to return to the notion of psychic intervention, which we have already studied in Homer, and to ask what part it played in the very different religious context of the Archaic Age. The simplest way to answer this is to look at some post-Homeric usages of the word ate, A-T-E, or its prose equivalent, theoblablea, and of the word demon. If we do so, we shall find that in some respects the epic tradition is reproduced with remarkable fidelity. Ate still stands for irrational, as distinct from rationally purposive behavior. Irrational. The way in which consciousness would envision this in an accurate theater of the mind, the rational is purposiveness like an arrow of intentionality leading to a goal. And the phase form record of the passage of that intentionality and its accuracy would be the form of a logical argument. Every argument leads to a conclusion, which would be the purpose of the whole activity. Whereas the irrational would be like a curlicue, like a pig's tail. It most obviously has no intention to reach any goal except just to squiggle around. So the Greek word, the ancient Greek word, ate, is irrational. Ate still stands for irrational as distinct from rationally purposive behavior. E.g., on hearing that Phaedra won't eat, the chorus inquires whether this is due to ate or to a suicidal purpose. Ate's seat is still the thumos or the phrenes, and the agencies that cause it are much the same as in Homer, mostly an unidentified demon or god or gods, more rarely a specific Olympian, and as we have in the Bacchae, it is Dionysus, who is the divine cause. He's the mythic image of the divine cause. Dionysus as the mythic image of life energy. Don't mistake it for sexuality. It's much broader than sexuality. Sexuality would be a major expression of it, but it's life energy. It's life energy in the sense that the staff, the scepter of Dionysus, is a fennel stalk with ivy entwined around it. The the fennel stalk is not so easy for us to appreciate. When Prometheus stole fire from the gods and gave it to man, he transported it in a fennel stalk. That is, when divine creativity, the spark of insight, which is the Promethean gift to man, is transported in a fennel stalk. A fennel stalk is able to carry the quintessential fire of life. And the ivy as an image of the protean aspect of life. So Dionysus is a mythic image of life energy, the elan, the dynamic in life itself. So that we have in the Bacchae an odd kind of a situation. Man is trying to fight his life energy itself. Can this be? You can see the inherent impossibility. Can we fight life energy ourselves? In making the attempt even, we set at odds our most powerful role of the ego against its own energy base. How can this even be attempted or possible? Because one has passed through the natural cycle into consciousness. And in consciousness, one is convinced that the psychic energy comes from within and not from nature without. The psychic energy that consciousness recognizes comes from me and not from nature. And the certainty of this is the built-in tragedy, the built-in tragic view of life of the 4th century Greeks. We still, incidentally, have this in large measure. To mature from this is very difficult. Very, very difficult. I want to give you a couple of comments on Euripides now. This one is from Helen Foley's wonderful book, Ritual Irony, Poetry and Sacrifice in Euripides, published, I think, by Cornell University Press. She has a wonderful insight into the Bacchae. She writes, Euripides' Bacchae demands interpretation on many levels. Most critics have read the play primarily as a religious statement. The poet offers a defense of Dionysus in a drama of justified divine retribution, or attacks Dionysiac religion and, by implication, other similar contemporary Athenian mystery cults. And in fact, if you read the Bacchae at all closely, you can see both views are equally tenable. Pentheus is condemned because of his hubris, but also from the same token, the Dionysiac religion is condemned for destroying this beautiful conscious capacity of man. Either way, the truth is that the Bacchae presents both montage together. Euripides is very, very sophisticated. And the old 70-year-old Euripides could have sat in this room quite adequately. 2,400 years makes no difference. We haven't come that far. He saw that both aspects together are the reality. It's not just a dilemma for man that has hubris, but it's a dilemma for a level of religion that has mythic images like Dionysus, is also in the same peril. It isn't just that man has this hubris, has this symbolic consciousness that is freed from nature and goes under its own psychic steam. The truth is that the gods of the old mythic realm also, by subsuming man, also are responsible for the very same thing. Their hubris, their arrogance. to pull a man who has been born and freed back into the womb, as it were. This also is an arrogance of that mythological level. And Euripides' Bacchae presents to us a most fearful, tragic realization that man and divine are both caught in the same dilemma. They are both, in their own ways, at an arrogant, impassable crossroad. And as I said before, the Greek consciousness never redounded from the recognition of this tragedy. The resolution came 400 years later in Alexandria. It took an awful long time to resolve this. Let me skip over here to another volume published by Princeton, Dionysiac Poetics in Euripides' Bacchae by Charles Siegel. And he writes in here, one of the conspicuous qualities in the Bacchae is that Pentheus, in getting set up for this hubris, getting set up to be put on the top of that pine tree, is induced by Dionysius to dress as a woman. He gets Pentheus interested in observing, in being a spy on the Bacchae. The women are doing these disgusting, horrible things. Don't you want to see so that you can feed your disgust? And yes, that's what I want to do. You have to be disguised. You can't go as a man. They'll tear you apart. You must be disguised as a woman, you see. Siegel writes, in this interim space, the initiate's temporary loss of identity as his past self is negated is often symbolically represented as a death and rebirth. This imagery plays some part in the Bacchae, though with a characteristic inversion. When Pentheus encounters Dionysus in the apparition of a bull in the darkness of the palace, another initiatory passage, he strains to throw the noose about the beast and breathes out his spirit as if he were dying. The next scene, the robing scene, opens with Pentheus seeing the light of the sun, the symbolical rebirth from darkness to light, except that the light is anomalously doubled. He sees a double sun. He sees two suns. It's Euripides' way of poetically saying that the protagonist now is seeing double, but seeing double in a way that he can't resolve them to an allegorical, mysterious unity. He just sees double. He's caught in the perilous pendulum of identity. You see, identity is always a problem. If you're able to conceive of yourself in terms of an identity, you already have a deep problem. Fortunately, it's the human problem. Everyone has this problem. Because the only way in which one can express an identity is for something to be expressed in terms of something else. A equals A, and you can say, well, they're both A. But as long as the equal sign is there, you always have that short circuit of a tautology. And it's the consciousness of the tautological necessity for balancing in terms of that short circuit that leads one to finally to experience the existential angst, the uncertainty, is this really me? Or is this really all of me? And that angst is the killer. The machines have died off here.